Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, and over the next 30 minutes, I'll bring you the latest headlines from South Africa and around the globe. Whether you're tuning in live or catching the podcast a little later, please stay with us for in-depth conversation with leading business minds, political influencers, and key newsmakers. It's everything you need to stay informed, quick, sharp, and straight to the point. It's Thursday, the 31st of October, and on the program today, why developing countries will need trillions to meet climate change goals. Fiscal consolidation versus stimulating growth. How do we do it? What's going on with the Ukraine visa mess? And do enterprise development programs help or hinder South Africa's entrepreneurs? South Africa's push for substantial climate financing takes centre stage at COP29, where the Environment Minister Dion George is calling for a massive increase from the original $100 billion to $1.3 trillion annually for developing nations. Minister George arguing this support is essential for South Africa and similar economies to transition to sustainable low-carbon development. The minister joins me first up on the program, and this is a very ambitious request. How do you arrive at that number?
Well, it's $1.3 trillion that we are putting onto the table. And where that comes from is that we do have an existential crisis in the world. And that number is looking at a global number that we believe the developed economy countries should be contributing to the developing economy countries. And that comes from the Paris Agreement. Now, the Paris Agreement, which was negotiated way back, and the discussions there that subsequently came from that was that the developed economy countries would contribute $100 billion per annum. And that was always a voluntary contribution, although it became a commitment that they made. Then subsequently, that $100 billion was not paid. And that was conceded by the developed economy countries, who said that they did not actually reach that number. But then they subsequently did. And they said that last year they met that $100 billion. But there is no simple accounting standard. And also there was a lot of discussion on, well, there was money paid towards development, for example, that wasn't specifically climate related, but that was all accounted for. So the question that I raised as the new minister from South Africa was that, well, why isn't there a single spreadsheet? And I mean, why isn't there accounting standard? Well, there isn't one. So that's where the sort of debate came up. And we think that kind of debate isn't particularly healthy, because if we're spending a lot of time on debating on whether the $100 billion was paid or not, we're actually not focusing on the actual problem. And the actual problem is that we need to respond to this existential crisis. So what we have said is that there is going to be a negotiation on the NCQG, which is the new collective quantified goal. And that is basically the contribution that would be made by the developed economy countries. So when we looked at what we think would be a reasonable negotiation position to take, was that we looked at what is required to respond. You look at South Africa, you look at other developing economy nations, the number is in the region of at least a trillion per annum.
Right. Minister, let me ask you this. Given that there is contention over that $100 billion, why do you think developed countries are then going to commit to a vastly larger target right now?
I think that it's more about having the conversation going in the right direction. So we've all agreed that if the developed economy countries have met that $100 billion, That's the one thing. The next thing we agree is that it's not enough money. We all agree that. Everybody does, even the developed economy countries. So we agree $100 billion isn't enough. There needs to be more investment in it. And that's when the conversation starts to get into the nut and the bolts. And that's basically to say there is an expectation that the developed economies would pay as they said they would pay. But we do know the reality of the situation, that many countries have taken a step to the right, so their electorates are less comfortable with contributing to other countries and in their transitions. That's the one thing. And the other thing is we've got geopolitical tensions. So we believe it's very important that the conversation is had. Now, obviously, everybody says, let's be ambitious, specifically Germany. They say, let's be ambitious in our targets because we're setting the nationally determined contributions, you know, towards cutting back emissions, etc. So if we're going to be ambitious, well, then let's talk about how you pay for ambition, because ambition doesn't come for free.
Minister, let me suggest to you that is a very noble approach. But given the current economic pressures globally, surely this is not an opportune moment to push for such a recommitment or an increase.
Well, I think that, remember, it's an ongoing thing. So COP is every single year. So there's a lot of eyes now focused on COP 30, which is going to be in Brazil next year. And that's where the NDCs are going to be discussed and finalized. That's the nationally determined contributions, because each nation looks at what they can contribute towards making sure that we don't go over the 1.5 degree global warming number. So COP 30 is going to obviously be a continuation of COP 29. But we do believe it's important that that conversation is started, even if we're not able to get to an agreement. So, for example, my counterpart from Australia, Chris Bowen, he is one of the co-chairs for the NCQG stream. And basically, I mean, he's already indicated that it's pretty rough already. And we expect that to be the case, but you have to have the conversation.
Minister, I understand that you've got to have the conversation, but that is fundamentally the problem here, is that you're already talking about COP 30 when COP 29 hasn't happened. The world simply kicks the can up the road on this issue all the time with no resolution.
Yes, that is what has been happening to now, but that's the point I'm trying to make, is that if we do defer the conversation, so if we say, well, yes, we know that there's been a shift to the right. Yes, we know countries are battling to pay this because economies are weak, etc. We're not going to go forward. And I think that's the crucial thing. So in COP 29, which is happening now, as you know, what we would like to walk away with is this, to say, right, we've conceded and agreed, everybody, that we have not done enough to mitigate the increase in emissions and to slow down the warming. So that's the one thing. Then we also agree that not enough money has been spent. Mm. Then we also have to agree is how do you crowd in then? So, for example, the private sector must get involved. We need climate resilient infrastructure investment, etc. The Minister of Finance mentioned that yesterday in the budget, the MTBPS, etc. So we know that we need to walk very firmly in a particular direction, but we need to break the cycle of running in the circle of saying, well, was this $100 billion spent or wasn't it? We've got to get beyond that conversation. Right. And I think that's the key thing. That's the South African position, is we're saying, look, let's not get stuck on whether you did or didn't, because there are some nations who like to be stuck in that position, because then we don't have to talk about the commitments. We don't have to talk about the action that you're going to take. Because remember, South Africa, as a sensible participant, we've got the Climate Change Act that the president has signed. It's not yet gazetted, but it will be shortly. I'm working on the targets. I'm working on sector emission targets. I'm looking at carbon budgets, etc. So South Africa is moving very swiftly in terms of getting legislation in place. Also, our just energy transition, we're moving on that with as much speed as we can. We know we're too slow, but we're speeding up. So from that position of being able to demonstrate our commitment, we're saying one of the complexities we have, obviously, is the financial stream. Yes, we've received money from the US, the UK, France, Germany. And the argument also has been is, look, if you've got money on the table and you haven't spent it, it's difficult to actually ask for more. And that's right. Obviously correct.
Minister Dion George, I'm going to leave it there. We are out of time, but I think you've sketched what is a very unique problem. And let's see how things pan out. I appreciate your time today. And thank you so much, Minister.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, in the wake of the Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana's medium-term budget, analysts today are weighing the impact of his fiscal consolidation efforts and public investment plans on our economic stability and growth. Let me bring you an expert view now from Professor Adrian Saville, Professor of Economics and Finance at the Gordon Institute of Business Science. Adrian, good afternoon to you. How realistic is the Minister's fiscal consolidation plan, given that propensity for ministers within the GNU to push for increased spending on social programs and other priorities? It's going to be a difficult one. It's a real conundrum.
Jeremy, it's great to be with you. As always, the budget is a balancing act. I would venture that true to form, our budget also is another exercise in kicking the can down the road. You know, keeping in mind that this is a medium-term budget policy statement, and so you don't get to see the big changes, the big needle movers. Rather, this is guidance and it's direction in terms of where we intend to go. And that then allows me to address your question directly. This reference to a fiscal anchor is the same promise, just dressed up in other language. We can rewind over multiple ministers in sequence who have promised us fiscal consolidation, and we just haven't seen it delivered. So, this reference to the fiscal anchor, really nice words. I don't see anything materially different in terms of the true intention to bite down hard on our habit of overspending.
In that respect, Adrian, I think one of the frightening figures to emerge were the debt service costs, which are nearing 22%, if I heard correctly, of tax revenue. Obviously, this will pose economic risks if global rates remain high and elevated.
Jeremy, in economics, there's a term called crowding out, which refers to what happens when government gets, overly big and squeezes out the private sector. And we've seen evidence of that over the last decade or so, where we got a very big bloated government, bureaucratic, lots of red tape, difficulty of doing business, increases in the cost of borrowing, etc. There is a however that we can add to this now, and that is that governments got into the business of crowding itself out. That the cost of borrowing is now shadowing over other critical spend. That's going to cause another set of really difficult challenges in a country that desperately needs spending on infrastructure and on social fabric. We're not spending on those things. Instead, we're paying down our debt, for which we have very little to show historically.
And Adrian, add to that mix the slow pace of logistics reform through Transnet partnerships. This is also going to pose an increased risk to growth forecast.
Let me not be as grumpy as I'm hearing myself sound. So the logistics reforms, they are underway. And I think Transnet today is much better than Transnet pre-Michelle Phillips. We've got some really important things happening. We're getting great evidence of the power of partnership, public-private partnership. That's been the game changer with regard to energy and reforms in both of those two critical networks are going to help lift our growth forecast, notwithstanding the fact, as you point out, that lift still doesn't bring us even close to the global average. So we continue to fall behind, with the world economy moving along 2.5-3% structural growth, and we moving along with 1-1.5% structural growth.
And Adrian, no more bailouts for SOEs. Boy, we've heard that before, but we also add to that this proposed public sector early retirement program, which is aiming to reduce costs. Let me get a view on both of those observations.
Well, the no more bailouts is I really wouldn't, I'm not a huge fan of, those promises that are just sort of sweeping undertakings. You want to bail out parts of the SOE cluster that needs bailing out, and then, it needs to be right-sized and put into strong form. So bailouts are not only important, they'd be critical in the case of vital institutions. Unfortunately, our habit again has been to throw good money after bad, SAA probably being the poster child of that point. Why we would need to the state to own an airline is simply beyond me. If it's just a sweeping undertaking, no more bailouts, I'd rather, take that than the undertaking of we'll bail out whoever needs it. But these also have tended to be, words that haven't been followed by action in the past. About early retirement, that can be a very expensive exercise because you need to provide people with parachutes if they're going to be encouraged out of the building. All of that said, our public sector is significantly overstaffed, and our public sector wage bill stands head and shoulders over almost all other emerging market counterparts. And it's not just that the wage bill is high, it's that the delivery out of that wage bill is low. So there's that's a blade that cuts both sides.
Always sharp and to the point. Adrian Saville, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's visa policy is under new scrutiny after an announcement on visa-free entry for Ukrainian diplomats sparked much internal discord. The situation raises questions about the consistency of South Africa's visa policies and a need for a more streamlined process, should I say. There has been much protest. Joining us now to discuss the gaps in visa policy and potential improvements is Marissa Jacobs, who is Managing Director at Expat Web. And Marissa, what do you see then as the main inconsistencies in this policy, particularly for diplomatic and business visitors?
So, Jeremy, I think it can easily be seen as a political issue. And obviously, there's plenty of eyes on whether the government of national unity will show signs of strain. However, from my perspective as an immigration specialist, and if we talk from a business perspective, I don't think that the matter is very difficult to reconcile. From a BUSA perspective, business hasn't given a formal view, but I've spoken to some senior representatives and someone summarized it well by saying that we are aware that the DA ministers didn't attend the BRICS summit in Russia with the president. And if anything, we would welcome the opening up of visa regulations to facilitate tourism and growth, economic growth, to as many as possible of our valued partners. And if I add to that in terms of what Schreiber said on signing of the historical agreement granting visa-free access for Ukrainian passport holders and vice versa. And I think that vice versa part is so important. I'm sure South Africans too would welcome many more similar agreements, which would of course strengthen the South African passport.
And to that point exactly, it does beg the question, I guess, is why we don't have more consistent visa guidelines, which would go a long way to improving all diplomatic relationships.
Absolutely. I mean, I had the opportunity of I deal quite regularly with the Russian embassy, and they have a very good embassy in South Africa that's extremely pro-business. And I engaged with them on this matter to get their view. And they said that they wanted to emphasize that they firmly maintain a policy of non-interference in internal affairs of foreign states. They hold a deep respect for state sovereignty. And at the same time, they are attentive to monitoring the internal developments and drawing informed conclusions based on their observations. So I think in general, there is a positive support for as many as possible of these relationships and building on visa-free travel.
And Marissa, to that point exactly, and particularly pertaining to business travel, there would be specific areas where our visa process falls short compared to other nations, and that needs to be fixed.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we have a very cumbersome visa process, not just for long-term work visas, but also for visitor visas, which is why visa-free travel is so important. We saw that when the minister recently published a directive on the 8th of October, where he specifically instructed embassy officials as well as e-visa processing agents to say, stop adding additional requirements to business visa applicants who want to travel to South Africa for business. We want to make it easier for business and for holiday travel. We want to make it easier for foreign nationals to come into South Africa and to grow our economy. So definitely agree with that.
But having said that, though, you'll also agree with me that any visa-free agreement does come with both benefit but risk. So South Africa's also got to make sure that it weighs up those two factors to ensure security on the one hand, but also enhancing mobility on the other.
Absolutely. Any engagement with the Department of Home Affairs, they will always start the discussion off with saying that you must remember Home Affairs' role first and foremost is to secure the borders and to make sure that that is at the forefront of any policy regarding immigration development.
So do you think then, as a result of this issue being brought to the fore, there are particular visa categories or processes that would maybe benefit from a more digital approach, which would obviously improve processing times and, I guess, efficiency as well?
Definitely. I mean, the business visa and the holiday traveler visa has been rolled out quite a while ago to go onto an e-visa system. It's not perfect, and we know that the Department of Home Affairs is focusing on fixing that. They just yesterday published the Trusted Tour Operator Scheme, where they are specifically looking at enhancing tourism visas for India and China travelers to attract more tourists and to build the economy, but only for those that form part of trusted tour operator groups, which of course then adds to that security element. But certainly we also see with the simplifying of many work visa categories that is obviously important for business to attract foreign skills and foreign talent, that simplification will definitely enable the Department of Home Affairs to add even those categories onto an automation or e-visa type of system, which we know is the long-term vision of our new minister.
How is this Ukraine issue going to be solved then, or has it been already?
It has been very silent at the moment, so we'll wait to see how it uncovers, but the sentiment definitely at this stage is that it will proceed and that visa-free travel will go forward.
Marissa Jacobs, Managing Director at Expat Web, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Let's finish with this item. Despite billions invested annually in enterprise development for South African SMMEs, concerns are growing over the long-term effectiveness of these programs. Now, Edge Growth, which is an SME development funder, along with the Gordon Institute of Business Science, have released a white paper. It's called Enhancing Enterprise and Supplier Development Ecosystem Effectiveness, and it analyzes challenges and identifying strategy for improvement. Joining us now is Nabila Valley, who is Head of Business Development at Edge Growth. And Nabila, first of all then, what in your opinion are the main gaps identified in development when it comes to ESD programs?
I mean, you know, the thing is about the thing about this research is that it's important, and what it does is that it gives you a human-centric feeling to what the issues are. I think just before I get into what those issues are, to frame it for you, SMEs provide 34% of the South African GDP. They also, employ 60% of our labor force, but 70% of them fail within the first 5 years. So enterprise and supply development is at the forefront of helping to reduce that negative debt. So when it comes to this research, it's important to understand that we're unpacking what are the things that we can do better and what are the things that we've done great. So I think just to give you a sense of what that looks like, firstly, it starts off with a philosophy and understanding at a corporate level, and there are three main players in this ecosystem. It's the corporates, it's the SMEs themselves, and then it's the BDS service providers. So when it comes to the first insight, we're seeing that actually your philosophy around SME development and support is very important to understanding where whether your programs are going to be effective or not. So that's the first thing. When you have a compliance lens, you're actually just going to stay a tick box corporate. You're not going to be in the game for the long haul. The second one is where your business strategy is tied into your SME development strategy, and you have a triple bottom line approach. That's where SMEs and BDSPs and corporates actually reach a level of cohesion and collaboration. That's where we're making sustainable impact. And I think the last one, Jeremy, from an insight perspective, is that we still have a very long way to go when it comes to measuring impact. What does it, defining it? What is a theory of change that works for SMEs in the South African ecosystem? And then, you know, depending on the sector you play in, when you want to develop an SME, what is the evidence-based support that you're providing for that SME to grow? So, for example, in a mining or host community, your theory of change for a mining SME is actually to grow their revenue and diversify it away from the mine so that they can sell their products or services in Gauteng, for example.
Why do you think these problems or these gaps exist in spite of the fact that often the funding is there?
Yeah. So I think it's a couple of things. I think there's firstly the reasoning behind why it exists or the problems exist is a lack of collaboration amongst the players in the ecosystem. But then there's also a lack of understanding of what the SME really needs. We've applied this blanket approach to SME development support over the years and said, well, you know, generic stuff work, but it doesn't. It doesn't work in the long haul. And now that ESD is aligning with the elements of SDGs and ESGs, it's becoming more imperative to have a functioning a definition of what change looks like.
So what are those principal pillars of support that are needed then?
So I think it's three main things. Number one is access to skills, but skills that matter to the business, that remove an impediment to growth for that business. So don't teach an SME finance 101 or marketing 101 when they already know that. Teach them or enable them to remove an impediment to growth. So health and safety certification, for example, they can't afford it. So enable that for them, number one. Number two, access to finance. Most of black entrepreneurs in the South African ecosystem cannot access funding at conventional banking institutions. It's too expensive. The credit ratings are not geared up to take into consideration their context.
Often because it's high risk.
Absolutely.
One's got to have some sympathy for the banks.
100%. But then it overgears that business from day one. Mm. And so the reality is that it needs to be access to affordable understanding capital that comes with post-investment support. And then the last one is you can put all the skills you want in a business and all the finance, but if you don't enable access to market opportunities and growing, helping them grow their revenue and their top line, then you just create dependent businesses. So those are the pillars of support that actually need to come together.
What do you think in an ideal world a truly integrated ESD system or ecosystem would look like?
I think in an ideal world, what it would look like is firstly the various partners of this ecosystem playing together, and it would look like cross-sector support and impact where, you know, sectors are adjacent to each other and they see the value of developing SMEs using their combined enterprise and supply development contributions. It will also look like, you know, us decreasing that failure rate by encouraging youth in South Africa to get into entrepreneurship, but then at the same time helping them along that journey. And yeah, then it will also look like having good impact measurements and metrics that we can then look back and say, look, here's the evidence that shows we've made a difference.
One of the earlier points you made was that the ecosystem itself lacks genuine collaboration. And yeah, I understand that, but isn't the nature of business messy, competitive, it's changing all the time, and it's difficult to solidify the kind of collaboration that you're talking about? It sounds very idealistic to me.
It does sound idealistic, but I think, you know, in the space that we play in, it's much more easier for collaboration. So it's much more easier for collaboration because of the work that we do. So there's elements of support that a funder can do, but will need to collaborate with somebody who's providing capacity building support. And then, you know, off the back of a collaboration with corporates who are seeing joint value in supporting these SMEs. I think it's easier for collaboration in the SME ecosystem and the development space that we play in than any other space to collaborate. So it does sound idealistic, but I think it's achievable.
Just finally then, what do the small businesses themselves need to do to in order to make their voices more strident?
Yeah, so I think the research, what I like about the research is it brings their voice out. So there's 41 interviews and you can hear and feel the emotion of the SMEs. One of the insights says that the SMEs are actually, they're fatigued. to go through programs. So I think the thing that they need to do is just understand or align themselves with initiatives that actually enable change in their business,
providing they can find those initiatives.
Exactly. So I think there's work to be done to go and find them, but also on the parts of the corporates and the BDSPs to communicate those programs are available and this is what they're enabling for the SME. So yeah.
Do you have any sense of optimism?
I do.
Why?
Because I still believe in the work that we're doing and because I see the change on a daily basis. I see the impact on a daily basis. So when you're sitting across an entrepreneur and he's, is a grown man crying on the phone saying, thank you for the funding because now I don't have to make a decision between my kid's school fees and my employee's salary, there's the difference. And that keeps the optimism alive.
Nabila Vali, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time. Head of Business Development at Edge Growth. It is an SME development fund. And just before we sign off on our online poll today, either via X or Twitter, and relating to my interview a little earlier with the Environment Minister, do you believe that South Africa can effectively reach its climate goals? Yes, it needs more political will, or no. And as I say, you can participate either via X or LinkedIn. And that is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.